Okay, I'm going now to talk about the power struggle that is taking place besides the domestic desire for Haig to own or control, I say own, both the foreign policy and the domestic policy in case of emergency service. You see, the Office of Emergency Service included James McCord at the time of Watergate. He belonged to a 16-man team in case of national or international emergencies, and he was never prosecuted or never went to jail at the time of Watergate. He represented the CIA, the FBI, the White House. They had their only walkie-talkies, radio communications, and they determine the crisis and tell the president if the crisis is necessary to take control, and they also take control if the president is away. And it was very important to Haig to have control of both the domestic and the foreign policies, and quickly, a week early and long before he expected the decision to be made, and he thought he'd be head of this team, they put George Bush in, and he was mad. Now, in addition to that, there is a terrible power struggle going on in Washington, D.C., because even though Haig has power, he's very obnoxious, and there are a lot of people there that can't deal with this gross way that he is handling himself and making statements such as the way the nuns were killed in El Salvador without any basis, or statements about terrorism in Europe that have been disputed coming from the Soviet Union, that have been disputed even by the CIA. Now, the feud going on in Ronald Reagan's administration, which is just 3 months old, I refer to the old Black Sambo syndrome. Remember Black Sambo? He had a nice mother who made him a beautiful coat and pants and an umbrella and pretty shoes and a hat, and he went off and with his pretty outfit, and then the tiger saw him, and one tiger took the hat and one tiger took the shoes and the umbrella. Each one thought he was the most beautiful, and eventually they were all chasing each other and hopefully melted into a lot of butter that he later took home for his pancakes. Well, in this White House feud, you have Alexander Haig, who worked with Robert Kennedy's administration, literally a spy within the Kennedy camp at the time of Bay of Pigs, and then worked for LBJ in the National Security Council when Kennedy was killed, and joined the assassination team of Rocky and Kissinger and moved his way up. He jumped over 240 other people in the military to get handpicked by Rockefeller to be in the position he's in today, and worked closely, as I say, with Butterfield when Nixon was pushed out. And this gave Haig, the Secretary of State, the position he wanted and has today. Haig has been behind the scenes long before the Bay of Pigs and the killing of Kennedy by the combination of the CIA, the Defense Department, the anti-Castro Cubans. Also under this roof, under Haig, is Walter Stessel. He was in the State Department in Germany. He was in Poland. He was in Brazil. He was in the Soviet Union when Lee and Marina Oswald were there. And he's the gentleman from the State Department who's talking loudly about the blockade against Cuba. Each one has their favorite shtick, and Stessel's taking the Cuba one, and Haig is going with the terrorism. The Russians are the greatest terrorists in the world. I might have mentioned on the program before, I used to live next door to Walter Stessel. He lived next door to my folks. The Stessels moved away. His mother's still friendly with my folks. He went to Beverly Hills High School, and I knew him when I was growing up. He's right under Haig right now at this time and knows what went on in terms of the Kennedy assassination because of Lee and Marina working for the government and the CIA and Navy intelligence while they were in the Soviet Union, and Marina coming back with Lee. Under them and along with them is Richard Pipes, who's been opening his mouth and giving speeches. The USSR must give up communism or go to war. They have to change their form of government or fight. Pipes is a student of Harvard out of the school of Priscilla Johnson, who went to Harvard, went to Soviet Union, was in the CIA, greeting Lee Harvey Oswald over there. Pipes was associated with John Paisley. They both worked for George Bush under the Russian Division of Studying Russia and Strategies Against Russia, Team A and B. Paisley was murdered, and Pipes took over the main position. And he's our expert on Tsarist Soviet terrorism, that it's in the blood of Russians to be terrorists because the Tsars were terrorists and taught it to the Bolsheviks, and that's why they can't give up terrorism. And then under them is Richard Allen, or along with him from the National Security, Ronald Reagan's assistant there, who says that the Allies are too pacifist. His shtick is that it's better to be dead than red, and he's telling our allies hey, you're too soft now. You'd rather be red than dead. And he's been scolding the Allies, and they're not sure they want nuclear weapons in Europe. So Richard Allen, that's his speech. He gave that speech before the Young Americans for Freedom last week. Young Americans for Freedom was formed by William Buckley in the CIA with Douglas Caddy. Robert Morris of the early House of Investigation Committees, the Internal Security, left Washington to go down to Texas in 1962 to help form Young Americans for Freedom. And that's when Volkmar Schmidt and Larry Schmidt and Bernard Weissman and a group from Germany, military intelligence, U.S. military working in Germany, came to the Dallas area for the Kennedy assassination. So he was speaking to this group of Young Americans for Freedom who got their start planning to take over the United States, and part of the plan included killing Kennedy. And William Casey of the OSS, CIA, days, he's the other part of this team. He was very much in the news at the time of Watergate. He was getting $10,000 a month from Robert Vesco as an attorney. He was involved with the security exchange scandals, the money that had gone out of there. Bernie Kornfield and Vesco connections were hushed up at the time that Casey was brought into the Reagan team. But any book on Watergate goes into these dogs very clearly. And so that every single person on this team knows what went on in the past and knows about each other's roles. So just like the Tigers and Black Sammo Hagg can wear the hats, Dessel can have the shoes, Pipes can have the coat, Allen can have the pants, and Casey can have the umbrella. And they're going to go round and round and shoot their mouth off while our allies are listening. And no matter what they say, there's no way that they could win a war with the Soviet Union now or even later, I don't believe. And yet they're determined to speak and scream about the Soviet Union being aggressive in Afghanistan or in Poland. And we're having problems that may bring us to World War III in Poland right now that were instigated and caused by these teams of Brzezinski and Kissinger and so forth. But no matter how we edge them on or nudge them on, I guarantee you the United States is not ready to go to war over the Polish situation, even if the troops went in tomorrow. And if we went to war, we couldn't win. So these teams... this team really needs psychiatrists. I think they're mentally sick. They're power greedy. They have been told nothing but reinforcement reports that have nothing to do with the world as it is today. And yet they shoot their mouth off, and our allies are sitting back. And I don't have time this evening to read a whole series of headlines from foreign press and domestic about our allies at this time. Now, I got a letter from one of my subscribers to these tapes who follows them very seriously and asked me to give a description of Fritz Kramer, K-R-A-E-M-E-R. He was the man who, in quotes, discovered Henry Kissinger. And I looked up some sources, and you can find his name in the Index of Libraries. He's the one man who discovered two Secretary of States, Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. So you know that Kramer has to be an important person. In one book that I have on Kramer and Kissinger, it's called Henry Kissinger, Private or Public Story, written by Ralph Blumenfeld of the New York Post. It's a very favorable book to Henry Kissinger because the people who did the interviewing all had links or covered the basis that Henry Kissinger was involved in satisfactorily. One of the authors was in Furth, Germany. The other interviewed people from U.S. Army counterintelligence, and the other from the Rockefeller staff. But even a book written by people very close to Kissinger does reveal a lot of information. And it goes into the fact that Kissinger rose from U.S. military intelligence, from Nazi Germany, to U.S. military intelligence, to Harvard, to the Rockefeller Empire, to Nixon's White House, and so forth. He never encountered violence from Nazis. This book says when he lived in Germany and was a young person, he came to the United States. He had close contacts in Furth, Germany, with a man named Harold Reisner, R-I-Reisner, R-E-I-S-S-N-E-R, who became head of the Reisner Chemical Company in New York City. He moved in with a Christian family after the war. He had two close friends who were Protestants, Carl Friedrich and this Fritz Kramer. Friedrich was his professor of government at Harvard, and Kramer went on to the Pentagon to be political advisor, and as I say, the man who discovered Henry Kissinger. Kissinger became a United States citizen, and then when he was 22, went into Germany just as the war was winding down into U.S. Army intelligence. And in 1950s, he was teaching at Harvard University. I mentioned on another program that he was informing for the FBI and CIA on various students that were maybe too liberal or too left, as when he was a professor at Harvard, he was a snitch for the Defense Intelligence Agency. He left Harvard in 1954 to be on the Council of Foreign Relations in New York and write their policy under Nelson Rockefeller. And he was very close to a Ruhr businessman, this Kramer, who he knew. And this book describes him as a devout Christian, a noble Prussian, went to law school in Germany in 1933, had a Swedish wife, this is Fritz Kramer, who he sent to Great Britain when the war was coming down in Germany. He studied international law and got two PhDs in Italy. His wife came to Germany and got the family jewels and cash out. And in 1945, when Henry Kissinger came into Germany in May, when the war was over, Kissinger and Kramer were working together. In May 1943, the book, The Nazis Go Underground, describes the meetings of top Nazis to retrench because they realized that Hitler couldn't win the war against Russia. And it was about this time that Kissinger and Kramer made their connections. And then Kramer went on into the Pentagon to military political work as a strategist. And Kissinger's other friend, Carl Friedrich, was the professor at Harvard. Now, at Harvard University, Sven Kramer, that's the son of Fritz, the man who discovered Henry Kissinger, he had a son who was a student at Harvard of Henry Kissinger when he was teaching there. And then Sven, the father, is in the Pentagon. His son joined the National Security Council. He also worked under Lyndon Johnson in 1967 when Haig was brought into the National Security Council, along with Butterfield, and then he became the aide to General Alexander Haig. So that Kissinger and Kramer and Haig and a group of people have been very close from the end of World War II up to the present time until they're managing our entire State Department these days. It was Haig. Among those who recommended Alexander Haig as Kissinger's deputy was Fritz Kramer, who worked with Haig in the early 60s in the Pentagon, and then also Kramer's son was a student of Kissinger's and recommended to the staff of Haig and National Security Council. So Sven Kramer, it was his son, worked with Haig and had high Pentagon positions, so that the father and the son and the Holy Ghost, being Alexander Haig, all were very cozy. The two Kramers and Haig and Kissinger have been close to this day. In a newspaper, the Revolutionary Worker, January 16th, 1981, there's an article, a background of Haig's past. They described how he left NATO because it was too soft on the Soviet Union when he was working for Carter. He was the head of NATO. He married the daughter of a four-star general. He'd gone to West Point, but his political career brought him for a while into the camp of Robert Kennedy until the Bay of Pigs invasion. And then after John Kennedy was murdered, he jumped right to, from colonel to major general in 69, working for Joseph Califano and Nixon and Kissinger, and took his position in the White House. As soon as Nixon won the election, finally in 1968, was inaugurated in 69, that's when Haig went into the White House, and that's when Butterfield was brought back from Australia. And Butterfield and Haig had been in the Pentagon together. He was promoted over 240 more senior officers. He became a four-star general, deputy chief of staff of the Army, and controlled the White House under Richard Nixon at the time that his buddy Alexander Butterfield was bugging Richard Nixon, and those tapes would remove Richard Nixon from being in office. There's an article by David Broder called The Haig Ego that was in the paper this Sunday, March 29th, and it tells about Haig working in the Army 17 years in 1964, going on to Washington and to the Pentagon and working for Joseph Califano. And there was a formula here. He had E equals the ego plus the White House equals trouble, that Haig knows too much, and they he published Broder, a formula about Haig being working in the White House and now being in the State Department. He doesn't like just being in the State Department. Broder said Haig doesn't like being in the State Department because he knows too much about the White House inner workings, and he doesn't like to be that far isolated from all these other people strutting their stuff. Now, along with the problems of the Wells Fargo international connections from Japan to Nigeria and African countries, and this missing money and the Australian connections, which link to Paisley and Bush and Haig and Pipes, along with that, other countries are having their problems. And in the remaining 10 minutes, I'll just briefly run down as fast as I can some of the other scandals that are taking place. One has to do with the Wall Street Journal story this week. France's elections are in jeopardy. French president's re-election campaign flawed by the Bokassa diamond controversy. The London Sunday Telegraph has an article about the silence of the $250,000 worth of diamonds that are missing. 187 documents have disappeared. Richard Delpe, an author, has written the articles about the connections of massacres of children in Africa and payments of diamonds to Valérie Giscard d'Estaing, who wants to run for president again of France shortly. And this article says that he's in danger because of his connections to these scandals. D'Estaing got favors in Bokassa from down in Africa for hunting, game hunting, and killing wild animals, which was not really allowed. He was down there, and he was paid off in $250,000 worth of diamonds. The main papers are missing, and one of the riders was killed in a plane crash, and this is scandalizing the elections in France. Then there was another article just the beginning of this year, the end of November of 80, Fraudissimo Gusher, an oil scandal in Italy, and this had to do with the Christian Democratic Party Prime Minister Arnaldo Forlani, 5 weeks in office, written up in Time magazine. $17 million in investment properties has been mismanaged. That's $17 million over there, $250,000 in diamonds in France, and they're worried about the scandal because 2,000 people might be involved in this scandal that affects the Italian government, and right now at the present time, there's been 100 arrests. We're not getting much in our local papers about that, are we? But the Italian government is very shaky, and this has to do with oil scandal. I don't know whether it links to the Wells Fargo or not, because that was coming down about at the same time. But $17 million involved in the prime minister of Italy, who had only been in office 5 weeks. In Germany, another article, the government is in trouble there that may involve the election of Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. It has to do with $50 million that is missing from the Berlin Treasury. That's $250,000 missing, or payment, not missing, of diamonds allegedly given in France to a man running for president of France, Valérie Giscard d'Estaing. The Italian prime minister, $17 million floating around investment properties and oil, a scandal, 100 arrests and 2,000 may be involved. And in Germany, there's $50 million missing from the West Berlin Treasury, and it has to do with the collapse of a Middle East project, a $2 million loss on that, and $50 million. And according to the Los Angeles Times article of March the 12th, scandal triggers a threat to the rule of West Berlin by social Democrats. And as I say, we are having our troubles in the United States with the Wells Fargo story and the Nugent handbag. And the common denominator between the French, the English, and the United States, Italian scandals is money, narcotics, murders, missing documents. In one case, it's diamonds. The others, it's lots of money missing. As I say, $17 million figure in Italy, $50 million in West Germany, $250,000 of payoff in diamonds in France. $55 million of the United States CIA in Australia, and $200 to $300 million Beverly Hills and California Wells Fargo. If you can add fast, you can figure that out. Otherwise, you can send for sheets that accompany this tape if you have a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll give you the newspaper sources of the information. Now, you top that off with there's recent sex scandals in Great Britain. The head of the British intelligence, who retired recently, died last week of unknown cause in an unknown place at an unknown time, the former chief of all British intelligence. And then this week there was another upheaval, a book coming out, a British writer alleging that one of their top officials of the government had a house where he had sex parties, Tom Dreeberg, with members of parliament and the cabinet, with homosexual liaisons, and fixing up the top people of government, similar to Bruce Roberts' story of blackmail and gemstone files, the sort of fixing people up and getting the top heads of government compromised and photographed. Right on top of that story was the allegations that Sir Roger Hollis, the former head of British counterintelligence, the head, named in a book their trade as treachery by Chapman Pincher. They're saying this would make Kim Philby, that's the British agent, and Guy Burgess and Don McLean, those three of those were British agents that turned out to be Russian agents, look like small potatoes. These are stories about British intelligence, the head of British counterintelligence, and also the blackmailing photographing of heads of states, of the cabinets and members of parliament in very compromising positions. Another agent was named, and this one is a triple agent. Great Britain's a third spy is revealed, Charles Howard Dick Ellis. Now, this is an important one because he was Britain's number three intelligence officer at the end of World War II, but he not only spied for the KGB, he spied for the Nazis, and he was the deputy to Sir William Stevenson. Now, those of you who don't know that name can get the book or the paperback, A Man Called Intrepid. Sir William Stevenson was the head of British intelligence in the United States, who worked with Nelson Rockefeller and the organization called Permandex, and John Paisley and the assassination teams of North and South America. And according to the Associated Press, he was a native of Australia also. Stevenson was active in Australia and in South and North America with his intelligence. So if you want to read the book Intrepid, you will get a good background of Stevenson. And so you have these major spies who are linked now to scandals, to Nazis, to the Soviet Union, and then we, of course, have Margaret Thatcher denying in the press that there was no truth to any of the spy stories. On the 24th of March, she denied it, and then on the 24th of March, later in the day, she said she'll seek an investigation of British security scandals. And, of course, last year there was a story of Sir Anthony Blunt, the surveyor of the Queen's art, being a Soviet spy. And then the subject of Lord Trent investigating Sir Roger Hollis and believing that he could have been an agent. Now, with these various scandals going on, it seems hard for the United States to think of challenging the Soviet Union going into Poland, or with bravado putting up our war front. It seems to me that Italy and France and England and the United States have a lot of loose threads going. The newspapers have so many these past weeks that I could just go on and on for another 2 or 3 hours of the effect of some of these scandals. The United States is going to have an investigation, the FBI, of Paula Parkinson. Jack Anderson calls it the sex scam. Again, the gemstone story. Paula Parkinson is a lobbyist, and she works for a group of people that she has a particular group she lobbies for. It's called the Committee for Equitable Crop Insurance Legislation, and they want to ask her because she was having sex and photographing the people having sex with her who voted against the crop insurance that she lobbied against. She set up a lobby group in Washington, D.C., and her husband said they're going to write a book to show, in quotes, how Congress has become an elitist class and how a woman like Paula could come in and make things move like she did in a few months. This is the San Francisco Examiner, an article, U.S. agents want to talk to sexy lobbyists. And Jack Anderson has an article, Bear Bigwigs, Erotic Evenings in D.C. This is Jack Anderson, March 24th. Sex clubs in Washington meet every 2 weeks. Diplomatic members of Congress, officials of State Department, the Defense, the Treasury Departments, they meet at the Watergate Hotel, the L'Enfant Plaza Hotel. 5 to 7 men meet with 4 to 14 women and have sex orgies. Top generals from the Pentagon, congressional swingers, they rival the X-rayed movies, and members of Congress are all men and some staunch conservatives. And Jack Anderson says, in a White House of Baptists and moral majority, There's some fancy goings on the Potomac. So while this team in Washington is putting up their big, strong, anti-communist front and begging our allies to go along with us, they can barely wipe their behinds to keep up with all the things that are coming on. There are scandals in every major country. These heads of states are breaking down. They're losing millions of dollars. Besides that, there's high inflation and no progress economically in these countries. Japan doesn't want to keep arming for war. Germany doesn't want to keep arming for war. Holland doesn't want the nuclear weapons there. And I don't know how far Ronald Reagan and Haig and Allen and Bush and Pipes and Stetzel can push this thing. But I see a very weak, divided, decadent kind of a group of people that have been building themselves up to power. And I don't think that their behavior is going to allow them to swing the kind of things they want. It's going to be awfully hard to get a team of GIs, even in a time of depression, to go sit out in the Persian Gulf and defend what is going on in this country. The scandals never were cleaned up from the time Kennedy was murdered and the various assassinations and the narcotic dealing of the federal agents and Nixon and Reagan's connections and Paul Luxalt and the combination of narcotics and sex and money swindling and bank finagling is going to bring them down like the tigers that chased around in the Black Sambo story. I feel optimistic that even though the news is bad, I don't think they could call a war tomorrow and win. And I think we're going to see a lot of people, journalists and so forth, coming forward with more and more stories to stop their war mania. They came in Inauguration Day, Ronald Reagan came in blasting Russia. Haig was blasting Russia. But what they're doing, these verbal assaults don't equal the exposés that are on the other side of the pages. If you get past the front page, you'll find a scandal a minute, and the scandals involve them, not us. And that is the optimistic part about the bad news, is that if you read it carefully, they're all in trouble, and they better clean up their act, because who's going to die and fight for this bunch of swindlers? Well, that's enough news for you tonight. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. I'll be back with you next week, and you take care until then.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Bressel. This program originates from Carmel, California.